She was a member of the Women's Freedom League, and she was a co-director of the Minerva Publishing Company. And she had a great interest in various investments in companies, and used to go to all the annual meetings. Mm. You know, these boring annual meetings where people can go and listen to the chairman and give me his report. She used to go to all of them because she thought it was right that women should show themselves. The women shareholder was, well, quite influential, were a very large number. And she used to feel it was a duty to go to all these meetings, which she regularly did. Now, apart from that, and that she was a writer, and she also was, by way of being an artist, she used to sketch a good many cartoons for our paper, and took quite an active part. Beyond that, I didn't know her personally at all.
Yes, I'd come across her before.
You see, I was so busy with my own work that I could only meet these people on business. I couldn't...
In the evenings, really.
Yes, on meetings. Mm. I hadn't any time for any social, except with my friends. And Mrs. Thomson Price was one of those who I knew in the business, but I didn't know at all personally, really.
You did know Mrs. Despard quite well,
didn't
you?
Oh, yes, I knew Mrs. Despard.
Can you describe her home in Ypres that you went to? What was her home like?
That lovely home. Earnshaw Cottage, Isha. And a few years ago, we were coming back from a trip on a Sunday on the Guildford Road, and I said, let's stop at the Bull and have a drink to revive our flagging spirits before we go on to London. And when we got into the foyer, the entrance, it wasn't open. They were waiting to open. It was in a few minutes, you see. And there was someone also waiting, a lady and gentleman. And I spoke about it to Mrs. Blake, I think it was, about my visits in the old days to Earnshaw Cottage. And this lady says, excuse me, did you see Earnshaw Cottage? I said, yes, I did. Mrs. Despard used to live there. She says, you know, we live there now. It's our residence, Earnshaw Cottage. And it was a very nice, well, not suburban. It was more country than suburban, but not quite fully country, if you know what I mean. And it had a nice garden, and it had completely vegetarian living. And Mrs. Despard used to come there for the weekends. She used to often, though, cut them very short and go up on Sundays to the Independent Labour Party and various socialist gatherings. She was a socialist, you know. And that's why when the split in the WSPU happened, Mrs. Pankhurst did admit, she said, Mrs. Despard is an old lady and she has her loyalties to the socialist movement, and we can't really expect people like that to cut everything out and say this only the vote matters. And she was a little bit inclined to be more tolerant to Mrs. Despard because of that. But Mrs. Howe Martin and Mrs. Billing Gregg, she didn't excuse at all. She thought they were just breakers up of their society, because they had a different view from our own.
Mm. What was Mrs. Despard like as a speaker? Can you remember her speaking?
Yes, I can remember her speaking. She spoke much more with feeling than with... She was not a very logical speaker, but she spoke with deep feeling and with tremendous sympathy for the poor. And people in the audience rose to her, you know, because they felt she had that living sympathy with them, which she had. And down at Nine Elms, which was her London home then, she made a center for the poor people. She had a nurse there, and they dispensed ordinary simple medicines, and they looked after them when they were sick. And she did everything she could to help the poor of Nine Elms. In fact, I don't know whether you know it or not, but there is a Charlotte Despard Avenue at Nine Elms, named by the local council in her honour.
Yes. Oh, she was a well-known personality.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. But when she spoke, did she have a musical voice like Mrs. Pankhurst, or was she different?
She was different.
Because they were both emotional speakers in a way, weren't they?
Yes, but Mrs. Despard had much more pity in her speeches. She was always terrifically sympathetic to the bottom dog. Mm. And Mrs. Pankhurst had also a sympathetic voice, but I don't think she ever felt deeply, in the sense that Mrs. Despard did, for the real troubles of the poor.
She looked very impressive, of course, didn't she, Mrs. Despard?
Yes,
and
it
was that sort of heart and that sort of mantilla.
Yes, she did.
Yes. Could you tell me a bit about Edith Howe Martin as well? Because I don't know much about her. She was a scientist, wasn't she?
She was a BSc of London, and her husband was a lecturer at Dunton University, also in science. And Edith Howe Martin was a very attractive woman, physically attractive. She didn't look at all like the blue stocking. And I don't know how she married her husband Herbert, because he certainly was not attractive. And we had a dreadful experience, which I think I told you about, of a woman who was in the Freedom League, who was very noted for her indiscretions, who, when Herbert, Mrs. Howe Martin's husband, turned up at one of the functions — he very rarely did that, but on this occasion he came — and she was awfully taken with this rather odd-looking man. And finally she said to Mrs. Howe Martin, she said, "Who is this dreadful little worm following you about?" And it was her husband, which was very terrible, because Mrs. Howe Martin was quite attached to her husband. They were a very happy couple, I think. They didn't have any children, but they lived quite happily together up at the Garden City in Hampstead. And he continued to do it. He was not a lecturer, he was a reader. How does that?
Quite senior, in other words.
Mm. That's less, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. No, that's better.
Is it? Yeah.
It's nearly a professor.
Oh, I see. Well, he was a reader at Dunton University. Mm. And, of course, Mrs. Howe Martin, through her academic friends, was able to get a good deal of help when it came to making bombs and things. She was able to get high chemists to come and help her with the
incendiary sort of devices.
The things to drop in the post boxes and the things to drop in the ballot box.
Mm.
that was a Mr. Clayton, I think, of London University, who helped her with that. And somehow his name was leaked, and Mrs. Hammond was dreadfully upset about it, because she promised him that his name would be kept out of it. His career was at stake. And he helped with the, what do you call it? The mixture.
Yes, the chemical.
The chemical mixture. And that was the stuff they dropped in the ballot box at Bermondsey election.
Was it? I see.
And they burnt the papers. And when the charge was made against Alice Nealings by the polling presiding officer, The utmost that they could claim was that he damaged his trousers. That some of this stuff had fallen on his trousers and burnt a hole in them.
Did you ever meet Clayton?
No. Oh yes, 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 I did. I did, and I also knew his wife. But not well. Only casually at the WFL offices.
What sort of man was he? He was a feminist, was he?
Yes, they were convinced feminists. He was rather small, insignificant looking man. But interested in the movement and willing to do things for it. And his wife was also, well, she wore what was called jibbers, you know, these sort of semi-Indian dresses.
Yes, I know, yeah.
Not ordinary conventional dress.
Yes. Were there many women in the Women's Freedom League who believed in dress reform? Really?
Yes, quite a few. Quite a few. Now, Mrs. What was her name? Toyne. Mrs. Toyne, who married a man who was a lawyer. He wasn't practicing, but he was at the bar, and he lived at the inn. And they had a small child, Gabriel, who ultimately became a film producer, Gabriel Toyne, I don't know.
He went to my college, I think, Corpus.
Corpus.
I think.
Anyway, he was, as a boy, he was a very interesting kid. He was about, when he was about 5 or 6 years old, he could take you around the British Museum and show you everything. But Mrs. Toyne was a dress reformer, and they had a cottage in the country where they used to go, and she used to put him out as a baby, 1 or 2 years old, on the lawn, in a state of nature, you see, to get sunbathing. And some old colonel who lived with a looking over their garden, apparently, he wrote her an indignant letter to Mrs. Toyne about the naked baby that was allowed on the lawn, and that it must put a stop to that. And Mrs. Toyne wrote back and said that she had received his letter, and that if she received any further communication from him of any kind, she would join her son in a similar state of nakedness on the lawn. So she had the courage of her conviction. But they were a lot of dress reformers, yeah.
What did you, if you were a dress reformer in the women's movement, what would you wear then? What would you go in for?
Well, I think they mostly wore these one-piece jibber dresses, and much longer than we would be using at the time, right down to the ankles, in one piece. They're sort of Indian dress, really, isn't it?
What was the idea of them, really, these dresses? I mean,
well, I suppose they're not only simplicity, but also they thought they were more elegant. Mm. They thought they were more artistic than the modern dress that we were then using. Mm. And certainly the dress that women were then using, as far as the hats were concerned, were terrible. Mm. Did you see mine with the hat on?
Yes.
Terrible. Terrible.
Mrs. Billington Greig was a great friend of Mrs. Howe Martin, wasn't she?
Oh yes, they were great friends.
Why did they get on so well?
I don't know, because they were quite different. They were quite different people, but they got on very well together and they worked very well together. And Edith Howe Martin had a great affection and respect for Teresa. I think she realised she was a stronger character altogether, you know.
When you say they were different in character, what do you mean?
Well, Mrs. Howe Martin was the gentlest militant of them all. The gentlest militant of them all. and a very feminine sort of character, whereas Teresa was more dominant and physically more of a, she's a bigger person altogether. No, they weren't like at all, but they got on splendidly. That's how I should put it.
Yes, that's interesting. So there was one of the two things I wanted to ask you about your earlier life, which I forgot to ask you. Could you tell me what your brothers and sisters did for a living after when they ceased to be children? And what did they all do?
Well, my eldest brother was a lawyer. And he became president of the Northern District of the Law Society. And he became mayor, of course, and brought back the honour to the mayor, to the legal profession. And he lived the life of a provincial professional man and did a lot of public work. My next brother, Fred, oh, by the way, I have all the pictures in my bedroom. You didn't
I'd
see
like
them.
To have a look afterwards.
Behind a screen.
Oh, I saw the screen, yes, I wondered about it.
Behind the screen, all of us, at about the same age, individually taken.
Let's have a look at that.
Well, my brother Fred, he died at 30 in Asiatic Turkey. He caught one of the diseases which you get out there.
What was he doing out there?
Well, he was chief engineer at 30. Chief engineer for the London Mercantile Shipping Company. That's what he was doing out
Did
there.
He help you in
and,
your career?
And we only found later that he was paid extra salary because of it being a danger zone. We weren't thinking of the danger he was undergoing.
Did he help you or encourage you in
No, because I was too young. There was a lot of difference in our age, you see. There was 14 years difference between my eldest brother and myself. That's a big gap. That's a big gap. He used to be very very amusing with me, and he used to take me out and give me treats. But he didn't have anything to do with my work.
So that's two. You've done your eldest
that's
brother and Fred.
That's two. Then my eldest sister lived the life of a lady. She didn't do anything to earn any money at any time. My next sister, similarly, was at home for years. And it was only by my inveigling her that she came out. She didn't like it very much and she didn't do very much at it. But it was a change from home life. So that I was the only one on the feminine side who branched out to do anything. Then my youngest brother went out to China. He went out to China. He was in the relief of Pekin. I can show you the medal ribbon.
He was in the army, was he then?
No, I don't know. No, he wasn't in the army, but I think at the time of the Peking massacres, the allied countries, the people who were resident there, formed groups, you know, and they made a section that went out to help them in the relief of Peking.
Sort of volunteers,
right? Yeah, that's it. Anyway, he got the medal, it's in there. And, unfortunately, he got TB there, and throughout the rest of his life, it was a constant fight against ill health, really.
What was he? Was he a businessman out there?
No, he came back, and he was with the Mechanical Institute of Mechanical Engineers, but he was not really physically able to do very much, although he worked right up to the end of his life.
So So engineering really goes in the family, doesn't it?
In
you've
a
got
sort
two
of
brothers
way,
who are engineers,
yeah.
And you yourself.
Yeah.
Mm. Why is that, do you think? I mean,
I
is it just chance?
Well, in my case, it must have been chance, because I didn't take counsel with my brothers about it at all.
Mm. What about your sisters? Did your sisters disapprove of your suffragette activities?
No, they didn't. But they were highly nervous about it. Very nervous about the militants. They would have been better in Mrs. Fawcett's community.
But they didn't join anything? Okay.
No.
Not active at all, just
no.
Stayed at home?
They didn't join anything.
A bit boring.
Yes, but it was the way in which people lived in those days. Don't forget, we're talking about 70 years ago, you know.
Yes, so you were unusual,
it's very
really.
It's hard for you to carry your mind back 70 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did your parents think about your having a career? Were they keen on your having a
My
career?
My father was intensely proud of it. My father was extremely proud of it. He used to be always showing me off. And he used to take me off by myself to the continent for 2 or 3 days on our own in order that he might show me off as speaking French or doing anything that was clever. He thought I was a very clever, extraordinary person.
Did he give you a lot of encouragement from the beginning, or was it only after you'd been successful that he...
No, I think from the beginning.
Was it?
Mm. I think from the beginning, mm. Yes. I should say that.
Mm.
He certainly was a very liberal-minded person. There's very few parents all those years ago that would have been willing for a underage daughter to do the things that I was doing. Very few.
Your mother had more doubts, didn't she?
Oh, well, she didn't show them. She was very good. Because, you see, they could have stopped me. They could have stopped me. They only stopped me once. Really stopped me once when I announced that I had got a job in Brussels and that I was proposing to go there to take it up. They intervened then because I was only about 19, something like that, 20, before I really settled into my own particular job. And they didn't like that, they stopped that.
What was the job actually?
It was I was going to Brussels with a cigarette machinery company, the Molins Machine Company, as it is now, it still exists. Their two sons have passed away, and the father, whom I knew most in those days, was Mr. Molins himself, and he had this wonderful cigarette-making machine. Nobody had made automatic cigarettes until he arrived from America with this machine. It had a long channel of paper shaped, and it was filled with a kind of tubular feed of tobacco. And it went along in continuous supply, and it came to the end when it was cut off after being pasted. 500 cigarettes a minute, and that was how many years ago? That's what Mr. Molins had.
Why did you want a job with him then?
Why did I want to go with him?
Yes.
Well, I thought it would be very good for me to go to Brussels to perfect my French, which was what it is today, very rusty.
But what would the job have been? Was it?
And they say in France of me, where I have lived, they say Miss Dawson speaks French very well with a pronounced English accent.
But would you have been an engineer or a typist or what?
Going to be a secretary.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Mm. This was before you got the job with the Sheridan.
Yes, before I settled down to anything else.
I can see what your parents were frightened of. They were frightened of the white slave traffic.
The white slave traffic. Yes, they intervened there. But they didn't intervene in any of my other escapades.
What do you think...
They trusted me.
Yes,
now,
well,
I think that should be
lucky,
a lesson to parents.
Yes.
They trusted me.
Yes, you're very lucky. You said you went, in your early life, you went to the Red Lion training college place.
The Red Lion, the...
Red Lion Square.
The London, what's that called now?
London Training
College. University, something. Red Lion Square.
I know the one. Anyway, you were you actually taught by H.G. Wells?
No, I was taught by a man named Barlow, who was a mathematician. And he was really good. He was very good, he taught me a lot. I benefited greatly by being taught by him. The only thing he had was very dirty fingernails, which I didn't like. But his teaching was excellent. He was a science man.
Mm,
he was very good. Mm. I liked Mr. Barlow and he taught me a lot.
Mm. So you owe a lot.
And then at the same time I was going to the School of Economics under Professor Morgan for law.
Mm.
International law, constitutional law, getting a really good general
filling your gaps
on the picture, yeah.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah. Filling in gaps, yeah.
Yes. Were you very much influenced by any of these people? I mean, did any of them make a big impact on
Moore,
you?
Oh, Professor Morgan did.
Did he?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yes, and I never forgot old Barlow because he really was a very good teacher. I was having private tuition, you see.
Mm. Mm. Paid for by
school.
Your parents.
Yeah.
Mm. When did you give up the idea of law?
Oh, well, I never could entertain it because they wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Mm.
You see, Christabel had the same difficulty.
Mm.
There was no possibility of getting in.
Mm. Mm.
And the same with engineering, you see. Mm. It was the same with engineering.
Still, you prevailed with engineering.
I was very friendly with a young man named Moore. He had a motorbicycle and so had I. And we used to go on trips on our motorbike. And he got his father, Dr. Moore, who was the head of the, he was the editor of engineering, the trade paper for engineering. And he got Dr. Moore to intervene personally at this mechanical institute to try and get me accepted. But they wouldn't have anything to do with it. And in the last resort I said, well, I'm sort of related to George Stevens. Does that do any good? Nothing mattered. There was no help for it except to go away and dig out your own future.
How do you spell Moore? It's M-A-W.
M-A-W.
I see, yes, yes. Why did you have a motorbike? That must have been very unusual.
Oh, I had the first motorbike. It was custom built. It was made by a man in Norfolk. On the coast. He made it for his daughter, who I think killed herself. It had a 2.5 horsepower Minerva engine, and it had a fixed, you couldn't, when you stopped, you had to stop the engine and stop everything, you know. You couldn't stop with the engine running. It was fixed. And I found it was rather troublesome, all this jumping in and out to restart the traffic. And I had a sidecar put on it. This sidecar was very low on the ground. And with the sidecar, I got on better. But I had to make a rule in the end that no one could come with me who couldn't jump on when it was going. They had to push off and then jump into the sidecar.
Why did you get a motorbike then? And what was it for?
Oh, really? I thought it was fun. That was just fun. It had nothing to do with my work. It was just to have something different from what other people had. And I took my mother riding in the sidecar.
Did you go from your flat in London to Dulwich on it then?
I went there, yes, and picked her up. She didn't like it very much. It was too low on the ground for an elderly woman.
You seem to have been rather a gay young spark.
I certainly was.
Do you think you're a bit wild in retrospect? I mean, were you a bit of a devil, do you think?
I suppose so, really, as you look at it, looking back. So, certainly in those days it was all very, very extraordinary.
Did you maintain the machine yourself, and did you repair it and look after it, or did you have someone to do that for you?
I didn't know anything about it really, except to drive it.
I wondered if it was part of your enthusiasm for engineering.
But in the end I knew more about them. And during the war, while we had to do dreadful things with them, I was in the ambulance section of Marylebone, and we had to lie out in the mud and change our wheels. Sort of thing. Horrible. Horrible. There's no need, really, for people to have to do that now, is there?
No, I agree. Did you, when you went to the WSPU, you did a lot of chalking of pavements and things like that, didn't you? What was it like, chalking pavements?
Well, it wasn't so bad. Roads, women, meetings, such a time.
You just sort of go along and then chalk it yourself?
Oh, we had to kneel down and
do
it, yeah.
Mm. And then you just write this down.
Yeah.
And then what would happen? Would people gather round?
Oh, people read it as they passed, you see, and it was notice of the meeting. And then again we had sandwich boards. We used to walk, and we had to walk along in the curb, below the curb for that, front and back.
Did you get a lot of rude remarks?
Oh, yes. But we got a lot of rude remarks. In any case, we were used to it.
What sort of things did they say, Miss Lawson?
Oh, go home and mind the baby. Why don't you go home and do the washing? Things that we were not accustomed to do in our way of life, but which the ordinary Hitler thought was a woman's problems.
It must have been very embarrassing for you doing this. I mean, as a sort of respectable
woman. Oh, yes. One felt very shy sometimes, having to break into these occupations.
It must have been really quite a thing to do, I would have thought.
It required a lot of spirit to do it. In fact, a lot of courage.
I'm sure it did. One thing I wanted to ask you about Mrs. Despard in the Women's Freedom League was really how much influence she had over the vote. I mean, did she control what went into the vote when you were running it? She gave you complete carte blanche.
Well, she had nothing to do with it, beyond giving her name to it. But I've just came across something here. The editor was retiring and said Mrs. Despard was going to take it over.
Because she did take it over eventually, didn't she? I wondered,
Well, she didn't really. Only in name. Here's something from the board.
Oh, yes, I've read that. Yes, that was tax resistance, I suppose, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. So she just left you to do what you liked, really, did she, with the vote? I mean.
Yes. She was the president of the Women's Freedom League, and to that extent was interested in the vote, but she didn't take any active part in it. Not really. But in this cutting I found here, the returning editor says Mrs. Despard is going to take it over.
That's right, because she did edit it for a few years after
you. Well, her name was on, but whether she really did the editing or not, I don't know.
Yes. But you went to America around about 1911, didn't you, before the war, and you gave up being managing director of the Minerva Company.
Yeah.
So, did you do any more work in the Women's Freedom League after that?
See if this will refresh my memory.
Because you went to America for quite a long time, didn't you?
Yes. But I remained a member of the Freedom League and was still a member when I came back.
Have a look. Was she? I mean...
A suffragist and a suffragette.
Was she really?
She marched in the processions. She was interested in one of the WSPU shops where they sold propaganda stuff.
I imagine that's all in the book that you very kindly given me.
And her partner, Dr. Bone, got herself arrested by mistake. She didn't want to be arrested because of her position in the medical world. But she was arrested. But she gave the name of Mary Jones. And I don't know how many Mary Joneses there may have been arrested, but a large number of women who didn't want their names known gave the name of Mary Jones.
Yes. You had a marvellous boss, didn't you? Your vice president.
Oh yes.
Was he keen on promoting women's careers?
Oh no. I mean, his idea was that we should all be shipped to a desert island and locked up there. And when I was resisting, when I went to Paris to see Christabel about fitting up a printing press secretly in order to get out the suffragette during the periods that the police seized the forms and everything. And I managed to acquire a printing press secretly and bought it and paid for it, and I had to use one of our invoice forms for the purpose of making the transaction, you see. And when the police, somebody at Lincoln House left it lying about, I suppose, and when the police got hold of it, they came at once to our offices to inquire into our doings with the women. Sherry was terrified. He was an American, he didn't want to be mixed up with the police anyway, and he didn't want to have anything to do with the woman's movement. And they came and these people were closeted with Mr. Sheridan. I was in the outer office wondering what was happening. And when I was summoned into the presence to know what this was all about, because he didn't know anything about it. And when I got there, I had to admit that I had used this form in order to get the papers I needed to clear the press, you see. But he was very worried about that. Didn't know what could go on in his absence behind his back. He might be involved in anything to do with the suffrage movement. But he had a very heart-to-heart talk with me about it.
What did he say?
Well, he said some very unreasonable things, which I thought unreasonable, but he didn't take any steps to punish me in any way for it.
He was against Spokes for Women anyway, was he? I mean...
He was against that, yeah.
Was he?
Yeah. Mm. But he was not against the advancement of an individual woman.
No, that's what I thought, you see. Did he really help you a lot?
Oh, very much. Mm. Very, very much.
Mm. He didn't try and hold you back at all then?
Not at all.
Because you're a woman.
Mm. And when I first went to America, I was a young woman. I had quite a job to get my position regulated amongst the ladies of the family, because they didn't know me, and Mr. Sheridan was my sponsor. Mm. And I had quite a job. I realized, although I was quite a girl, that the first thing I had to do was to convince them that I was not Mr. Sheridan's mistress. And that was the first thing. I soon did.
Yes.
I soon did.
You did it.
They all received me as a receptional person.
One thing I wanted to ask you, I didn't realise that you still had any contact with Christabel after you left the WSPU.
Oh yes, I did. Well, for the paper, you see, she was in Paris and the paper had been seized week after week and the forms broken up and everything stopped. And she was desperate to get help. And there were many of us went to her assistance. I particularly agreed to find a premises and start a secret printing press, and which I did. It was at Whitechapel, down in an underground basement. And I not only got the press, but got it erected there and got the machinery too, and got the motor to run it, and even got a printer, a kind of a, I think he was a Russian. he was very, very left in his ideas. I got this man who would print it, actually operate the machine in his spare time. Of course it would have been a very elementary kind of an effort, but it was all ready. We could have, and Christabel said, I, Christabel, will get the plates. I will get someone in Brussels who will get the plates from my copy and bring, smuggle the plates into England. And if you can put the plates on your machine and get away, we'll be all right. But you know, I never got a plate. No plates ever came, because I suppose it was too difficult. It was too difficult. And she was being watched.
So it was never used, in fact?
It was never used. It was dismantled and resold by me. I'm not sure it wasn't in connection with me selling that Mr. Sherrington was brought into it. And it was resold and the money was refunded. And when I got the money to buy it, Christabel said, well, I'll arrange for you to have the money paid to you. And if you will be in Sloane Square at a certain date, at a certain hour, you will find a lady wearing a flower who will stop and exchange the time of day with you, and she'll also give you an envelope. And the lady was Mrs. Merriweather. That's the Merriweather fire engines, you know. You know that name?
I don't know the name.
They're big people. And she was terribly anxious because they'd already begun pursuing Pethick Lawrence and saying that the husbands of all the women would be pursued. So she was really worried. But she managed. I'd never seen her before, nor she me, and she handed me the check. I'm not sure about the exact amount, whether it was £350 for the start or £500, I don't know, it was something betwixt or between. And she just handed it to me. She didn't know me, she'd never seen me before, but Christabel had asked her to do it, and she did it. You see, Christabel could call upon people for that kind of help.
You see, what surprises me, in a way, is that, you know, somebody who's left the WSPU and joined the Women's Freedom League, should it have anything to do with...
Oh, no, but we were still for the cause. We were all for the cause.
So you still admired Christabel, and you still...
Well, I felt that they had, in a way, they made good their case. They had said, we can't run this thing as a democratic society, because it's more like a war, and we must run it as an autocracy. Well, we didn't like the idea, and we left. But, in practice, they by far exceeded what we accomplished as a democratic society. Mm. They practically overran the country.
Mm. Yes. Why didn't you join the WSPU again, then?
Well, I was sufficiently occupied with the Freedom League. I was doing a useful job. I was running the paper.
Mm. But you lent support when asked.
And I was busy with my own affairs. But yeah. I never lost interest in the Women's Movement for a moment.
No, no. How did Christabel get hold of you in the first place from Paris, then?
Oh, she knew about me. She was in touch with her own assistants over here, and they knew about me. They also knew that I was associated with printing.
Yes, I see. So anyway, you got a message, did you, saying Christabel wants to see you?
I got a secret message.
Did you? Yes.
It was all very secret.
Yes. And then you went over to Paris, did you, to see her?
Several times, yes.
Did you really?
Yeah.
To arrange this printing press? Did you really? Well, no.
And we got our printing arranged, but we got no plates. We never got a plate.
What was Christabel's flat in Paris like? Could you describe it to me?
No. I can't remember a thing about it, except that it was in a building that was not, as I think, custom-built. It was not made, it was a house.
Adapted,
translated.
Yes, I see, yes.
Yeah, and she had a very comfortable sitting room.
So what...
But I don't remember much about the house.
Mm.
It's a long time ago, and I only came and went.
I wondered if you saw the shoulder-to-shoulder programs, because they had a picture of her house.
Of the flat,
that, you see. I wondered But what was she like when you went to see her? I mean, was she...
Oh, she was quite civil and pleasant, but she was very autocratic with everybody. And you know, I said to her, Christabel, I think this is probably one of the hardest things you've ever been asked to do, to come over here and be comfortable and situated as you are while your mother is hunger-striking. I said, it must be a dreadful strain upon you. She says, nobody asked me to do this, I decided to do it. It was my decision to do this. Perhaps if people had asked me, I might have thought about it differently. But I decided it was the best thing to do, and I did it. She wasn't really terribly worried about what her mother was suffering, she didn't seem to be.
Did you feel she was wrong, really, to do that? I mean, did you think she ought to have gone to prison?
Well, I don't know. I think if you're going to incite people to go to prison, you ought to be willing to go yourself. That's all. She'd been that once at Manchester.
She didn't like prison, of course, did she?
Oh, no, I mean, she was not having any more.
And do you think
she did a wonderful job out of prison.
Yes, yes. But there was something about prison that really upset her, wasn't there?
Yes,
I mean, it was
something
a sort of
psychologically, yeah.
Yes, yes. That's interesting. But a lot of people did criticise her. You weren't...
Oh, yes, quite a few. Especially as her mother was suffering so much.
Yes, yes.
And suffering in health and in every way. And her brother died, you see, while it was all going on.
What do you think about her in general in the movement? I mean, do you think she was a good influence on the movement, really?
I think she was the sort of leader who could produce the results and who would put aside all personal feelings altogether, either her own or anybody else's, in order to ride rough over the difficult pieces and get on with the job. I think the realization of her policies was what really mattered to her, and nothing much else.
That's quite true.
Yeah.
The thing is, there is a sort of hardness about her, isn't there? Ruthlessness about her, which
terribly
obviously one finds a bit unattractive as a person, but I suppose maybe you've just got to be like that in order to get this movement going.
Yes, and she must have had what I didn't particularly notice perhaps, which is a great personal magnetism. Because, you see, when she was out doing the open air speaking and everything, she always got the crowds. The crowds were always with her. She could command a crowd. And she must have had something that caused that to happen.
She attracted you, I suppose, as a young woman.
Everybody, in a way, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
She used to use her arms a lot, didn't she?
People have mentioned that. I didn't notice it particularly.
She was also quite good-looking as well.
Well, she was quite good-looking, and she was very young and girlish-looking. She looked much younger than she was, really. She was exactly my own age.
Was she really?
We were born in the same month, the same year.
You must have felt a bit identified with her in a way, because you wanted to go in the law as well, didn't you? You must have felt sympathetic to her in a way.
Yes. But I think I always realised that she was determined to go her way, that nothing would prevent her. I never had any worry about whether she would achieve her object. I was sure she would.
But still, the consequence of following a militant policy or a policy of violence is an authoritarian structure, really, isn't it? I mean,
that's the
two go together, don't they?
Yeah, it seems like that. Mm. It was not constant with a democratic society.
Mm. Mm. You did some tax resistance, didn't you?
Did some what?
Tax resistance.
Yes.
What
I did.
What did that involve?
There's a lot about that, isn't there?
Is there? Yes. Were you sold up?
Yes, we had what they call levy distraint, the bailiffs came, and they went away with some objects of value that they could sell to realise the amount of the taxes. And Mr. Code, an auctioneer in Southampton Row, used to do most of the sales for the tax surveyor. And our sales were so much a burden to him, year after year, and with this whole place crowded out with angry suffragettes demanding his blood off, that in the end he said he wouldn't do any more. And the tax inspector couldn't get anybody to take them on because they were so annoyed by having so many suffragettes howling around the premises and holding protest meetings inside and outside. So they then, in my case, they then dropped this distraint, this having the bailiff in, and adopted the High Court procedure. So it was on that High Court procedure that I finally got my last chance of getting into jail.
They just brought an action against you, you mean?
They bring action, yes. And then if you don't pay, they then bring another action. And then they bring an action for contempt of court, you see, for ignoring the judgments of the High Court. And when you don't obey their orders, you get a summons. They can take your body after that. And we just got to that stage when the King George V issued his amnesty.
Mm, in the war, you mean?
Mm. The beginning of the war.
But did you actually had some of your property sold up, did you?
Oh, yeah.
Did you
regularly,
really?
Year after year.
Did you buy it back?
It was bought back by sympathisers.
And given back to you?
Yeah. Mm. Yes. And you see, I was in Bloomsbury at that time, and we were very near Russell Square. So that in addition to the protest meetings at the sale rooms, we had large open-air meetings in Russell Square in order to protest against this scandalous behaviour.
So that was really quite a thing, wasn't it?
Well, it was a very logical way of resisting, I think.
Yeah. The only problem was you could never be sure that many women would cooperate, could you? I mean, it was only a few women.
No, well, we had a society, you know, the Women's Tax Resistance League, and of course there weren't so many qualified to do it, because there was you didn't pay under £150 a year, and any salaried woman getting more than that was rather unusual. You know, salaries were very low in those days. And the others, the married women, they were tied up with the husbands. And Mr. Wilkes, as I told you, he resisted his wife. She was a doctor. And he had to go to Brixton Jail.
So
not many married women would resist to the point of putting their husbands in that jeopardy.
Mm. Mm. That's interesting. But there was never any hope of getting a lot of people doing this, just because, as you say, very few women really
paid
taxes.
No, it was organised throughout the country. It wasn't only in London.
Mm.
And some made quite splashes over it, sort of locking themselves in their houses.
Well, Dora Montefiore did, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And Mrs. Harvey did at Bromley. And they made quite a lot of propaganda out of that. But I don't suppose there were more than 30 women altogether throughout the country who were able to do it.
Mm.
Many would have liked to do it.
Mm. You never thought of barricading yourself in your flat?
No, I had to be at work in the morning.
Yes, but you didn't...
I was rather handicapped.
The trouble with you is you've got two simultaneous campaigns going on, haven't you?
Yes.
One for women's suffrage and the other for women's career opportunities.
That's it.
And the two had a coffee
cup. They didn't take... They ought not to have come together.
Well, in a way, you're doing a double job, aren't you? Tell me about the roller skates.
Well, that year we had a census, and you know what that means. And we formed immediately a census resistance group of women who said, we don't count, we won't be counted. And determined that they wouldn't be counted, that they would stay out somehow, out of a house or roof, during the period when you had to be recorded. And our group, we took the Aldwych skating rink for the night. We had it. Nobody was supposed to be sleeping there. And we had roller skates, and we spent the night on roller skates, and there was no one to declare us. And when we went away in the morning, we were very weary, very tired with our roller skating. But we felt we'd done the government out of so many names on the census resistance. It wasn't very useful, really, but it was something to do. We used to grab at every little thing, you know, that we could make a protest about. It was advertising, really.
Why did you go roller skating? I mean, why did you choose
that? Well,
that
was a rink where you did roller skate. There was nothing else to do down there.
I see, it was just ready to pass the time.
It was a big rink where you did roller skate. Yeah, it was past the time.
It was not to keep moving, so
it wasn't everybody who could do it.
I'm sure you could, knowing your taste.
Yes, I could.
Yes. But, what happened after the women's movement? I mean, when Mrs. Pankhurst disbanded the WSPU and you got your amnesty,
yes, well,
what did you do then?
Well, we were in the war.
And did you stay in the firm all through the war in Sheridan?
Well, first of all, I had to get on with finding some evacuation premises. You couldn't stay in Berlin all through the war and the bombing. And I took my car and drove around, quite on spec, looking here and looking there, during the first two or three weeks of the war, to find out where I could place our business. And I found a place at Rickmansworth, at W.H. Smith's. They had a big shop, and above they had about three floors, which had been used by a hairdresser.
So this was to move the whole firm.
So I went down there and I found I could get the lease, and I had to take the hairdressing stuff. So I drove back in the car to my own hairdresser here in London. I said, look, I've got some hairdressing I want to get rid of, and it was very useful to you, all new stuff, cost next to nothing. You better come with me and look at it, and if you like it, you can take it away. My sole ambition was to get it out and get the place cleared. So he took it all. And within a couple of days I had three clear floors for offices, which was a good start. And then next thing I found, you see, we had a large store of machine parts, you know, which you had to have ready for immediate use when people had breakdown. And the next thing I found was a large garage, and I took that instantly. No questions asked about price or anything, because everybody else from London was on the same errand, all looking for premises.
Yes.
And I found this garage, and I thought, well, with all these stacks of shelves and everything, we'll be able to arrange all our parts and soon be in a position to carry on some sort of business. And from then on I got one place after another down at Rickmansworth, and we had quite a lot of space. And I kept an office in Gray's Inn for myself and my secretary, and all the rest of the stock was moved down. And of course the men had largely gone. We had a few kept as a reserved occupation, but that was all. They all went down to Rickmansworth, and then I had to find places for them to live down there.
Yes, yes.
Well, it was quite a problem, but we were soon settled, and throughout the war they stayed there. They had a few bombs nearby, but nothing very out of the way. And we didn't come back as a business, as a whole, until the end of the war.
So you stayed in Rickmans, well, in Grazing Road, in your job, all through the war, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, but I was going back and forth to Rickmansworth.
Yes, yes.
Where the business was.
Yes.
And then during the war, I was in the civil defence. And I was in the women's voluntary services.
Were you?
It was impossible for women to get any jobs, you know.
Was it?
No matter how much they had qualities or qualifications, they couldn't be accepted. They never wanted any women. Except to type or to...
To do the sort of subordinate yeah, things.
That's right.
Yes.
And I... then I joined the ambulance of the Paddington Borough Council. That was all night work during the bombing, because although we weren't always occupied with the bombs, we were always there.
Mm.
We had to stand by.
Yes, I see.
And when I went first there, the medical officer introduced me, and he showed me a room full of coffins, paper, double-faced corrugated board made into coffins. And he says, you won't have to handle the bodies. He says, the men will do that. If you get the coffins aboard and bring them up to the mortuary, you see. I thought it sounded altogether what one could do.
Mm-hmm.
But I soon found that the coffins were not required.
Mm-hmm.
All you needed was sacks.
Mm-hmm.
The coffins were no good.
This was in the First World War, was it?
No, the Second
World War. Oh, the Second World War.
This World War.
Yes, yes, I see.
The last World War.
Yes, because they did have some bombs, didn't they, in the First World War? Some
yeah,
bombs in London.
Yeah, no, this is this World War.
Oh, I see. The whole
in which I was in the 50s,
Rickmansworth and everything.
Yeah.
I see. What I meant was, what did you do in the First World War? And did you... You stayed in your job in the First World War as well, did you?
The First World War didn't touch us as civilians in the same way that the Second World War did.
No. Mm.
We were in the Women's Voluntary Reserve, Women's Volunteer Reserve in the First World War, but we never had anything to do.
Mm.
We were ready to do anything we were asked to do.
Mm.
I never had any real job in the First World War.
Didn't you? No. Yes, yes.
The Second World War, then I was with the Paddington Borough Council, with their ambulance corps.
Mm.
And as I say, we didn't need the coffins, we needed sacks, because they stripped them up and that was that.
And you were also in the Home Guard, you said?
Yes. Well, Dr. Summerskill, Lady Summerskill as she is now, headed the push to try to get women into the Home Guard. And that was one of the most difficult things to do, because Dad's army were, they were terrible, because they were so conservative as well, you see.
Yeah.
And it was a tremendous job she had to get in. But we got in, and Thomas Moore, who was the commanding officer of our 3rd City of London Corps, he said in the House of Commons, after it was over, when they were discussing the disbandment of the Home Guard, he said, I must say absolutely definitely that the two most valuable members of my battalion of the Home Guard were women. And they were women whom we'd supply to him. Because we, under Dr. Summerskill's guidance, we started this training centres to get women, and we got Dame Helen Winborne, who had been the head of the Women's Army in the First World War, and who was very well acquainted with everything, knew all about army bookkeeping and army stock keeping and everything. And we got her to help us. She came and lectured and gave them information, so that our young women when we did manage to push our way into the Home Guard, we got a band of young women who were really trained in army work and were ready for it. And that's why Sir Thomas More could say after the war was over that his two most valuable members were women.
That's a very interesting statement, isn't it?
It was, because they fought hard against having it. It's a dreadful idea to have to force your way into doing good, isn't it?
Well, it is really, but, you know, it's for the sake of people like my wife, really, that you you've done it, isn't it? Anyway, you didn't for yourself. I mean, by that time you were well established, weren't you?
I
mean,
oh,
you didn't
yes,
need to force.
I had no occasion to do it for myself.
I mean, you were quite well positioned by that time, weren't you?
Yes, yes. And I did a lot for the Women's Voluntary Services because I had a car, I had a Daimler, which was very large and sufficient. So that I did a tremendous lot of volunteers for them. Amongst other things I did was at Hamilton Terrace, St John's Wood, the houses are tremendously high, great big high old townhouses, you know. And the, from Whitehall they sent out a notice that all top floors must be cleared of everything so that when bombs dropped in they wouldn't have a lot of inflammable material about. So I had to help with that, and I went to help at Hamilton Terrace. And my God, I think I went 50 times up and down these stairs until I was pouring sweat to remove all their stuff that they got up there, because they were mostly elderly people who couldn't cope.
Yes.
And at their finish, there were a few pieces that were no good and not inflammable, sort of iron bedsteads, you see, and things like that. So I told these maids coming out, I said, there are these pieces, you'll have to give them to the dustman. She says, we can't do that. They wouldn't go up for them. They wouldn't go up for them, you see. They were quite willing to use us, women who were busy in other ways, to drag up and down with all this heavy stuff. But the dustman wouldn't go for them.
Yes. What happened after the war then, Miss Lawson? I mean, did you...
After the war, I was the first woman, I think, nearly, to arrive in America, because I was there before VE Day. I celebrated VE Day in America.
Did you?
And while I was there, after I came back, we had VJ. But when I got to America, I had a tremendous welcome from all my friends there.
Did you?
Who were all very much with us in the war. And they were so sorry for me, not having had enough to eat.
But anyway, you carried on as director, or as managing director, weren't you, until you retired then after that?
No, well, I appointed a new managing director when I went to France, because I wanted to get more time off. After all, I'd been about 25 years on the job. And I appointed George Kemp as managing director. And I became the active chairman. I was not just a stationary chairman, I was an active chairman, taking my full part in the business. But I had George, who did all the detailed work that I had been able to do. But I found, now you'll think this is a very self-important thing to say, but I found when I retired from the managing directorship, three men were needed to replace me. That's true. Three men. The reason being, you see, that they wouldn't be, they wouldn't do the things, they could do them, but they wouldn't do the things that interlapped. One of my jobs was, I had a house organ called Sheridan Sheaves, which came out not often, only every 3 months really, and I used to collect the matter for it and edit it and write it and see it through the press and everything to do with it. I never thought anything of it, it was just something I did. And you know, not one of these three men would look at it. They couldn't do it, they said, it was not their line. So someone special had to be got to them. and someone special had regard for something else.
Mm.
Because they wouldn't be all-rounders.
Mm. Mm. They were all specialists. Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, it's satisfying in a way, isn't it? It shows that you were, you know, you really
yes,
were being very active.
Yes, it's
natural
to say when I retired 3 men replaced me. But it's so. It happened like that. Now, is there anything here we have to look at?
Well, one person I did want to ask you about was Lady Astor. Did you have... you went to her parties, did you, at all?
Yes, I saw a lot of Lady Astor. And I was very fond of her.
Were you? Yes. I mean, she was a very controversial figure.
They criticised her terribly because she was... Well, she wasn't very logical.
No. If you read the parliamentary debates, she's always intervening, rather. You know, she's rather...
Butting in,
butting
yeah.
in, yes, yeah.
Like yeah. Winston's... Couldn't yeah. bear her, could he?
No, no.
And yet he was the mean her guests at all their parties and things.
Yes, yes. But she was a very volatile sort of
oh,
person.
Oh, she had great charm.
Mm.
She had tremendous personal charm. She was very good looking.
Yes. But not a great deal
and
of
And she
brain.
Did try.
Yes,
she tried. Really tried to do the job properly
mm.
and to adjust herself.
Hmm. Hmm. But she wasn't very intelligent in the sense of having a really logical mind, was she? Really?
And she hadn't had any training for it.
No, no. That's one of the tragedies, really. I mean, you said, you were very interesting, you said that the WSPU people didn't do very much after.
No, that's true.
That's an example, really, isn't it? I mean...
Because they weren't trained for anything.
Hmm. I mean, you could carry on and
it's
do
no
things.
It's no good going out for a job and they say, what can you say, I can chalk pavements. Or I can do this, that or the other. That is nothing to do with the practical work. When they should have been training for suitable occupations, they were busy with the WSPU to the extent that nothing else mattered at all.
So that explains why they didn't really become prominent after?
I think so.
Hmm, that's interesting. Hmm. Because there are, I must say, all the leaders drop out, don't they? Except Mrs. Pennock Lawrence. I suppose she remains quite active.
Yes, but only just.
Mm.
By going and presiding at meetings occasionally.
Mm. Mm. Not really dynamic.
The hearing got very bad. And she had one of these old-fashioned instruments which she put on the table when she was going to speak.
Did she? I didn't know that.
And it let off the most tremendous buzzes. All sorts of inappropriate times during her speech. And she couldn't hear it, you see, but the audience could. It was a dreadful business.
I didn't realise that.
Now, I think these cuttings are all to do with the peeresses and Lady Astor.
One thing I did want to ask you, and you may not want to answer this, but I was interested to know whether you followed your parents' religious beliefs. I mean, were you Wesleyan yourself, or did you abandon your religion, or not?
No, we never. We went to church religiously as children,
hmm.
and went to Sunday school, but I never took any interest in it afterwards.
No, well, nor have I. I just wondered if you kept that up, you know.
No, mm. I didn't.
Mm.
And I think my parents really ultimately dropped it.
Did they?
I think so. They, while the family was growing up, they were assiduous in their attention to church.
Mm.
But I don't remember that in their later lives.
Mm.
Certainly I never did.
No.
I haven't even been baptised in the Church of England.
Well, you must have had
I
such
was baptised in the Wesleyan Church.
Yes, yes. Well, there's so much else to do, isn't there, in your life? I mean, you've got so much else to do.
Those are all amazing.
Oh, yes.
That's when we went. It was the first woman to dine at the Chamber of Commerce.
You had spectacles in those days.
Yes, I'm short-sighted.
Yeah.
I've had everything from a monocle to my bare eyes.
Oh, well. Viscountess Rhonda succeeded her father,
yes,
didn't she?
Yes. They made the peerage. He was the first peer, Lord Rhonda, and they made it descendable as a female line.
Yes, that's really interesting. Yes. What about your politics, Miss Lawson? Did you, when you first had the vote, which way did you vote?
Well, you know, we were very much off politics by the fight for the vote.
Yes.
We were very discouraged everywhere from taking part with any political party because they always let us down. Mm. So we kept out of party politics, as you know. And afterwards in the party, I think in the earliest years, I voted Liberal. And then I joined the Conservatives. And I've been a member of the Conservative Party in our area, but I have been voting not Conservative in the last elections.
Didn't you really?
I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I think they've reduced the Conservative Party to non-entities.
Why did you feel that? I mean, because they weren't resisting...
Well, because first of all, I thought Mr. Heath's policies were very ineffective. And in some cases, rather disastrous. And when we ended up with the dreadful economic position and the three-day week and everything, and he didn't seem to have any definite policy for getting us out of these troubles. On the contrary, I think what they proposed to do would make us go further in.
Yes.
So I haven't been able to vote with them lately, although I still belong.
I rather sympathise with that. I voted Conservative the first election this year, but the second election I voted Labour, actually. I just didn't.
And I voted Liberal on the uncertain hope that there might be enough just to form a balancing party in case the others made a dead heat, which is pretty nearly what happens now.
Well, yes, it is in a way. Of course, one thing you did do, which you mentioned, was that you joined this women—not Women for Westminster, but what was it called? I wrote it down.
The Women's Election Committee.
Women's Election Committee. What was that actually? I hadn't.
That was to promote the election of women to Parliament by securing the adoption of women parliamentary candidates, and that was a very difficult thing to do, because first of all, it was party. Party came in there. It was a tough thing to ask a Labour woman to come along and promote the candidature of a Conservative woman because she happened to be a woman. It was a hard thing to do. However, when we started, there were only one or two. Yes, darling?
Feeling like a cup of tea?
A cup of tea?
Heavens, it's 10 to 4. I've gone on 20 minutes long and nice. Women's Election Committee. You were saying that it was non-party in its attitude, and this was a great strain.
Yeah, it was almost impossible to carry on a society of all party. However, we tried, and when we started by helping Mrs. Wintringham, both with money and help, and then we found that the main problem was to get in touch with the local selection committees, and these were people we didn't know and couldn't reach. But when a woman was clever enough to get herself selected, which wasn't very often, we were there to help. We helped with money, that we could do, because we collected money all the time, which we were saving up for them, and we could help with creating an atmosphere favourable to women in Parliament. To that extent we did. Anyway, when we started there were two, Lady Astor and then Mrs. Wintringham, through our help. But when we finished our work there were eight women members. And after that we decided that it was a party question and that the parties must deal with it.
Where did you get your money from?
Collected it.
From rich women, or?
Yes, from women suffragists and people who believed in the advancement of women, and we held meetings and we gave these dinners.